Hello and welcome to an Inside College Hockey podcast recorded Tuesday, January 15th, 2008. My name is Joe Gladyszewski, InsideCollegeHockey.com editor and senior writer covering the ECAC Hockey League. Joined tonight by Mike Eidelbus, Inch editor and columnist, and Jess Myers, senior writer covering the WCHA. We've got a lot to talk about in this podcast, a lot of hockey content, and as regular podcast listeners can expect, plenty of non-college hockey content, to be sure. But we'll start with what's going on out in the WCHA, a crazy week, lots of topics, and we'll start with the Denver-Wisconsin controversy from last Friday night. Jess, your thoughts on what's happened, and not so much what happened in the game, but what has happened since then, and whether this is going to be resolved in any sort of manner.
You know, I don't know that there is any satisfying way to resolve this. The WCHA looks bad. Let's just put it that way. They messed up. You know, Randy Schmidt, the referee, messed up. This is the second time it's been pointed out in a couple of months that they've had to apologize for an action by the same referee. Wisconsin has appealed what happened. A quick replay for those of you who don't know. Denver led 3-2, final seconds of Friday night's game. An apparent Wisconsin goal. Puck went in the net. The red light went on. The referee signaled goal.
Then
went and reviewed the tape and decided, no, it wasn't. Well, he didn't really look at tape. He looked at a still frame of video that showed the clock reading 0-0 and the puck outside the crease, but apparently the puck had gone into the net and then come back out prior to that. Now, here's my biggest question. Randy Schmidt on the ice signaled goal. Why did he go back to contradict himself? I guess I'm most puzzled by that. Anyway, Wisconsin's appealed it. I don't see this appeal going anywhere, just for the simple fact that what kind of can of worms are you opening if the WCHA says, yeah, we were wrong, then what do we do? I mean, do they fly Wisconsin out to Denver to play 5 minutes of overtime? Do they take a point away from Denver? I mean, there are a million ways you could proceed with this, and I don't think any of them are going to make anybody happy.
I would agree that it really it's a no-win situation for, you know, everybody involved. Obviously, Denver, you know, on the one hand, you know, obviously they're thrilled with getting a point that they probably shouldn't have gotten, or, you know, maybe never would have gotten. But at the same time, you don't want to, you know, win a game under or earn an extra point under false circumstances. Obviously, Wisconsin feels that they were cheated, and rightfully so. And I think, you know, it's a real serious black eye for a league that prides itself on being the best league in college hockey. You know, I think one thing, I'm not sure if I can, if I'm just, you know, if I'm just speculating here, is I guess what I'm trying to say, that a lot of times we hear about video replay being put in, and these things that you know, on the surface seem great. Wow, we've got video replay. What I wonder is if the people who operate the video replay and the officials are properly trained. Once this system is put in, my guess is, judging from what happened this weekend, no. You know, people are not properly trained in using a system. So, it's more than just having this great, wonderful technology in place that, you know, can solve these problems and correct these issues in these situations. But the people that are using this technology have to be able to actually understand what they're doing with it.
Here's another issue that came out of the situation, and both coaches commented on the record about it. Saturday night's game, the goal controversy happened on Friday. Saturday's game, again played in Denver, same official. He's in a no-win situation. And he could call a perfect game, and it could be a great game, and everyone can go home happy, but he's in a no-win situation whatsoever, no matter how that game turns out. First, Jess, as you're most familiar with this, is it customary for officials to work back-to-back nights? I would imagine that is true in Anchorage and Denver and CC, but what about if you've got, say, St. Cloud's home and Minnesota State is home and Minnesota's home?
It's been WCHA policy in the past, and Greg Shepard, the supervisor of officials, has always done it this way, that he has the same crew work both games of a series, barring anything unforeseen, you know, somebody getting hurt or you know, some kind of controversy. One of the Madison papers interviewed Bruce McLeod finally today and said, why would you have the same guy work this? And McLeod's answer was, well, you know, we didn't really realize that an apology was warranted until late in the day, and by then it was too late to change officials. Well, you know, CC was at home last weekend. You had another crew 70 miles away. And in fact, I heard both officiating crews were staying at the same hotel somewhere between Denver and Colorado Springs. And, you know, it would have been easy enough to just switch crews for that night. I think this brings into question this particular referee's future with the WCHA, the fact that this is twice in a couple of months that the league has had to apologize for not just missed calls. I mean, bad calls are part of the game, but potentially game-changing goal decisions. This is becoming a pretty big thing.
You know, I obviously agree with that. I just want to interject one thing. The WCHA's policy is to use the same officials in a series for the entire weekend. You know, and I can see some positives to that. You know, as far as, you know, if it's, you know, two teams that are kind of have a pretty heated contest on a Friday night, you come back Saturday night with the same official. You know, he kind of knows what to expect, and he can lay those ground rules out right away based on what he saw the previous night. But that said, you know, I know in the playoffs, when a series has gone three games on some occasions, at least it happened when I worked at Denver, and the Pioneers were up in North Dakota. We went to a third game against North Dakota in the first round, and there was a different officiating crew for the third night. So obviously there is a little bit of a precedent there. But I think ultimately this entire episode and the one that Jess mentioned in the past, or that happened earlier this year, you know,
ironically also involving Denver. I mean, it was another situation where a goal, you know, it was a Denver St. Cloud game in St. Cloud that Denver was the benefit of a weird call. You know, I'm not suggesting anything greater than that. I just think it's a weird coincidence.
But it's you know, ultimately I think, you know, it reflects on the integrity of the WCHA, and, you know, not just that a referee blew a call, but I think just in the aftermath and the way it was handled, kind of, you know, it seemed like a real clumsy response to a very, you know, serious situation, something that was, you know, the league's response to this incident was, you know, just I think it wasn't managed very well, and I think ultimately it reflects, you know, it makes the WCHA look pretty bad.
One more question, Jess. I get a lot of emails from many of the sports information offices and public relations departments from around the nation. Did the WCHA issue the official apology release on Saturday afternoon from its main communications office, or was it sent out only by the University of Wisconsin?
Doug Spencer, the WCHA's Director of Media Relations, was in Duluth last weekend.
Okay.
With his family, he took in the Minnesota State. Apologies to my friend.
The artist formerly known as Mankato.
The artist formerly known as Mankato. And they're no longer the Indians, just so you know. I saw Doug. I was at the game in Duluth Saturday night, and I didn't know about the situation until that moment, until I walked in the press box in Duluth, and he said, yeah, I had to write this apology up a couple hours ago and send it out. Now, there were photocopies of the WCHA release sitting on the table in the press box in Duluth, so I grabbed one there. It wasn't until the next day that I got home and checked my email, and I saw that Paul Capobianco, the sports information guy from Wisconsin, is who I had received it from. So I don't know how it was distributed. If it was maybe just written by Doug and posted on WCHA.com, or if it was sent out and I just didn't get the email for some reason. But the one place I did indeed get the email sent to me from was from the University of Wisconsin.
I can I can confirm that I got the email from the WCHA as well.
Okay. So maybe it's just a miscommunication. But it was nice of the University of Wisconsin to do double duty and get it out to us, and just to make sure we all knew.
Yeah.
Indeed.
You want to hear the WCHA's nightmare scenario?
Here, Randy Schmidt reps a Denver.
No.
Or Wisconsin St. Cloud Final Five game.
It's much bigger than that. It's, I think, pretty widely known that the first round of the WCHA playoffs, the league gets the money for the tickets sold for the first round. Now, I'm not suggesting any kind of conspiracy, but let's face it. If Wisconsin, which has a 14,000-seat building, is at home, and Minnesota, which has a 10,000-seat building, is at home, the league makes a lot more money than if, you know, Michigan Tech or Minnesota State, which have 3,000 to 4,000-seat buildings, are at home for those weekends. What are you guys thinking is going to be the talk around the WCHA offices if Wisconsin misses out on home ice by 1 point?
It's coming out of somebody's paycheck.
I just thought, wow, what a nightmare that would be. And again,
do they really make revenues in that first round?
Oh,
they sell out the X.
Oh, you bet they do.
Being a simpleton from the East, you know, here that I am, I'm still flabbergasted that they
University of Minnesota charges $30 a ticket for 10,000 seats. That's $300,000 every time they open the door.
That's insane.
You know what the best part about it is, though, is that they'll sell standing room tickets.
Yeah.
And then what I think the policy, and Jess, obviously you know it better, is that after the first period, if nobody's in a seat, you can go sit there. So in essence, they get to
ten minutes in. They, and I don't know. You know, I'm not. They have to wear helmets on the bench, but I know. In past years, they have sold rush tickets, which is essentially 8 minutes into the game, they do a quick count of how many empty seats they see, and then 10 minutes into the game, you can go up to the ticket office and buy what's called a rush ticket, which essentially just gets you in the door. It doesn't get you a seat. But if the ticket office officials see that there are 300 empty seats, they'll go ahead and sell 300 rush tickets. I think they're at a discounted price. And basically it's, yeah, come on in, you can watch the rest of the game, find a seat if you can. If not, you're going to have to stand.
So you sell they're selling the same seat twice.
Right.
What a racket.
Yeah, oh yeah, they're doing all right. Plus, yeah. You know, $9 a car to park, so...
But at the far end of the spectrum.
Yeah. Do they serve beer at the Mariucci?
They do not.
No.
That sucks.
they have a private club room which serves, I believe, beer and wine. But that's
the gifted people.
Right. That's $1,000 or more.
They have wine coolers.
That's right.
Well, that's great.
But in response to your original question, yeah, the league does pretty well on those.
It still blows me away that they can sell out the X for 5 separate admissions for those 5 games. That's unbelievable to me.
I
applaud it. I appreciate it. That's crazy.
It's a big event. And I tell you, what impressed me the most was a couple years ago when it was CC and Denver in the final in St. Paul, and there were legitimately like 16,000 people there.
Yeah.
You know, it definitely wasn't as full as you see if it's, you know, Minnesota playing North Dakota or St. Cloud playing Minnesota or something like that, but it was a legitimate crowd that the New York Islanders would have envied.
8.
I think my church choir is a crowd that the New York Islanders put in.
Wow.
Okay, let's stay in Minnesota. and talk about the Gophers. They've been a popular podcast topic all year long. And they got a loss and a tie against St. Cloud State Huskies last weekend. And
they're not your Huskies, not your Huskies anymore?
I like all 59 teams.
Way to jump ship.
Okay, so my Huskies got 3 points off the Gophers.
Wow.
The news is that after early departure news and other kinds of news that has been going on, now they've got goaltending news that Jeff Prezy was pulled after starting, pulled with a 2-1 lead after the first period. In the Saturday game at the National Hockey Center, home of my Huskies. And he may not be back in for a little bit. There's only a certain point, and we're at a point. Obviously, again, just speculating because that's what we do. But just, you know, there comes a point when you've got to push the button and make a decision and say, this is obviously not the answer. Is that maybe what's going on in Minnesota?
I think that's pretty clearly what's going on. The team, from what I can tell, doesn't have much confidence in Jeff right now. And frankly, I don't know how Frazee can have much confidence in himself. I mean, I think his head more than his skills are maybe the problem right now. Because, I mean, I've seen Frazee play some great hockey. And, you know, he came up through the National Development Team program and, you know, was a widely highly regarded kid. You know, he's I'll put it this way, and you know, Sunday night I saw Ilya Brizgalov play for the Phoenix Coyotes, and he just wasn't very good. And Wayne Gretzky put it real simply afterwards. He said he's better than that, and he said I'll talk with him, see if he's tired, whatever, but he's better than that. And I will say the same thing about Jeff Frazee. I think he's better than that. Now, the Gopher student fans in section 14 who are chanting "We want Kangas" would disagree with me at this point, but you know, I don't know what the answer is. I don't know what he's got to do to get his confidence back and get his game back.
I think I can agree with you that he's better than that, but the problem is that we've seen more of the bad Jeff Frazee. We've seen that goalie more consistently than we've seen the good Jeff Frazee.
Yeah.
Definitely, the team looks more relaxed, whereas in front of Frazee, it's like they're walking on eggshells. And, you know, it's about giving your team a chance to win, and for as talented as Frazee is, and we've seen it, you know, we saw it in the World Juniors last year where he came in after Zatkov struggled, and he played really well for the U.S. team. But for some reason, that just hasn't translated over to Minnesota, and you know, maybe I think that the Gophers are going to have to say it's time to take a new direction here.
Yeah.
And to his credit, Kangas has played really well when he's
he looks like a very good young goalie.
Yes, very, very good goalie.
There's a popular saying among some of the hockey people I talk to that is very simple. It's, what are you doing? And how is it working? Obviously, maybe at this point, the Minnesota coaching staff has decided that Frazee isn't working. And it's not it's just a decision they have to make for, as you both said, what's best for the team right now.
You know, the other thing, too, and I think Jess can probably vouch for it, you know, since he sees the Gophers on a more regular basis than I do, at least in person, being a goalie at Minnesota is kind of like being a quarterback at Notre Dame. You know, everybody's eyes are on you. Every little mistake that you make is going to be scrutinized and analyzed and second-guessed and doubted. And it takes you've got to be a mentally strong person to endure the kind of criticism and just, you know, round-the-clock scrutiny that you face in that position. And obviously, you know, with the advent of the internet and message boards and people like us who sit and yap about this kind of stuff now, you know, it's just that much more intense. And, you know, maybe Jeff Frazee, for all his talent, just isn't cut out to be in this position with the Gophers.
I would agree with that, and I would say even more so in a year like this when there are other elements that aren't clicking. You know, the defense is lesser experience than what they've seen in the past, and they're not scoring goals like they're accustomed to. In the past, you know, Minnesota could get by with an Adam Hauser or to, you know, Tom Newman, or, you know, go back to Steve DeBus. I mean, some of the goalies they've had that weren't, you know, widely renowned, weren't all WCHA first, second, or third team guys, but did enough for a team with that much defensive talent and that much offensive talent to win. This year, you need more than enough out of a goalie at Minnesota, and they haven't gotten it yet. And that's added to the list of problems that are plaguing Minnesota right now.
Staying on this Saturday game, it ended up 4-4. Both goalies got yanked. Both starting goalies got yanked. Minnesota had a 2-1 lead. There were several matching minors throughout the game.
Minnesota had a 4-1 lead.
Yeah, 2-1 lead after one. They went up 4-1 on a shorty.
Talk about a tie that feels like a loss. Wow.
Yeah, they're up 4-1. St. Cloud's goalie gets yanked. I'm just pointing some of these elements, and that's a good point, Jess. They're up 2-1 after one. They're up on a shorty halfway through the game. They're up 4-1. St. Cloud comes back, ties the game up with 10 minutes left. In the third, it wasn't like they had to get it late to tie it up. And both teams get a point. It's like 5 minutes of overtime and Olympic ice and up and down, whatever else. And Patrick Roycey in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, in a column that was posted on the Inch newsstand, said, "This is okay. I enjoyed my night at the rink, and I didn't need a fabricated breakaway contest to decide, you know, who won or lost." And it hit home with me because I've always felt that way. I'm not crazy about the shootout thing. I think it's kind of contrived, and to decide a game or make people feel happy or put on a show of skill, okay. When it has an impact on points in the standings, I'm really not crazy about it. And I've seen more of it this year in the National Hockey League that I think teams are shutting it down for the last 5, 8, 10 minutes of a given game, a regular season game. Okay, we can stay here at 2-2 and make sure we go to overtime and get our point, and then we'll send out, you know, then we'll join the rush, those kinds of things. So what do you guys think on that?
I agree 100%, and I think on a podcast last year, if memory serves me correct, and, you know, that's always a 50-50 proposition at best, I went on the record as really opposing it from a college standpoint, just because, you know, you look at how many of, you know, look at the Hockey East, for example. You know, every team, it seems, has about 5 ties in the league. You know, if you get to the point where a team has 8, 9 ties, you're talking about a pretty significant bump in points in the league standings, assuming all of them come within in league play, based on the results of a shootout. And, you know, looking at a shootout, I've been to NHL games that have, you know, ended with a shootout, and is it exciting? Well, no, not really. I didn't find it exciting. It's kind of, to me, it's deciding a game on a shootout is kind of like the way college football decides does their overtime, you know?
No, different.
No, well, in the sense that...
Because it's still football.
But it is still football, but you take a very important segment of the game out of the mix, special teams. I mean, you always hear coaches say, you know, it's one-third offense, one-third defense, one-third special teams. And to take that out of the mix when you're deciding the outcome of a game, I have a problem with that.
Well, they do. There's kicking.
Well,
They start on the 25.
No, I know that, but there's not punting. I think they should kick off. I don't want to get off too far off the subject, but what I'm saying is...
yeah, we'll get to this later.
I mean, this would be
was,
like...
What if there was punting in football overtime? Wouldn't that be exciting?
Well, I mean,
fourth and 10 from the 25 out. We're gonna give it up.
We need more punting.
No, what I'm saying is play like the NFL, where you punt. You know, you have to go out there and cover a kick, and who knows, a guy returns it. But you know, a shootout
I think it's important for both teams to get the ball.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that.
How about do hockey shootouts that way, where you flip a coin, and the team that starts, if they score on the shootout, they win. It's over. The other team doesn't get a chance.
I guess
they start on the power play.
You know, I guess maybe a better analogy would be, do you decide a baseball game that's tied after 9 innings by having a home run derby? What are you just going to send, your three biggest guys, best hitters up again? Yeah. I mean, it involves part of the game, but not all of it, certainly not all of the game, and, certainly it takes a lot of elements out of the mix.
Yeah, no, you're right on that.
Well, Mike, I would disagree with you and just say that I think shootouts are exciting. I have kids. There's nothing better for them than to watch, an NHL shootout, especially when, a team they like is involved. The fans love them. But I agree with you from the purity standpoint and from a college hockey standpoint. I mean, you look at the league I covered, the WCHA, 28 league games. With that few games, you can't have something like a shootout deciding, standing points, who's going to win, who's going to get in the NCAA tournament, things of that type. It's just the season's not long enough.
That's exactly it, Jess. There's not sample space.
Exactly.
ECAC hockey that I cover has 22 league games.
And you're easily looking at teams having, a quarter to a third of their league games decided by a shootout, and that's just not
right. It's not even the shootout to me. It's the extra point in the standings.
Right. Exactly.
We wouldn't accuse anyone of collusion, but who's to say that two travel partners playing a home-and-home can't just give each other the wink and the nod with 5 minutes left and say, hey, at least we'll get something out of this.
Right.
And then we'll go and play against, U State next weekend and then fight for it there.
Having been in a few NHL locker rooms after shootout victories or losses, teams don't really look at them that way.
No.
I've never seen an NHL team lose a shootout and be down in the dumps because, oh, man, we lost a game. It's like, hey, we got a point. They won that fluky thing at the end, but whatever.
No, you're 100% correct.
And from a writer's standpoint, they're awful.
Oh, yeah.
Trying to sum up a game on deadline when you don't know who's going to win until the last shot. I mean, come on. That's just, that's probably here nor there.
No, but I think it gets to the bigger point, which is it's not indicative of, what happened in the previous 65 minutes. You can have one team that's, very explosive, high-powered offense and a team that doesn't have quite as much talent but plays a good system. I'm not saying trapping. I'm not saying playing defensive, but, a good hard forecheck that really keeps that other offensive team on its heels for 65 minutes, and then, the team A gets an extra point because they've got better guys, better shooters. I don't think it's really indicative of the game as a whole.
I like the home run derby analogy.
I hate the shootout. I absolutely hate it. I think it's ridiculous.
I hadn't thought of the home run derby idea. But instead of a shootout, then why don't we go to like a skills competition after 5 minutes of overtime?
Why don't we just end in a tie?
Well, that would be simple.
If it's good enough for Wayne Gretzky, and if it's good enough for Gordie Howe, and Stan Mikita, and those guys, enough for Sidney Crosby and Ovechkin, and
Saint Louis and Le Cavalier and all those guys.
Yeah. Why don't we put a
10-minute overtime then?
Why don't? Yeah, I don't.
I would be okay with a 10-minute OT.
I would too.
That 10-minute OT.
In my early years of college, the WCHA played 10-minute overtimes, and then they switched to 5 minutes.
They screwed that up.
I don't know what the advantage of one or the other is.
The 4-on-4 part of overtime is more exciting to me than the shootout.
Oh, yeah, especially if you get a hooking call or a tripping call.
Oh, yeah, then it's just...
4-on-3 power play? Oh, it's unbelievable.
that's the best, and that's, and you rarely see it, but that's, you know, that's the best hockey I think there is just wide open ice. And
although I read about this, I think it was on ESPN.com, 5 minute NHL overtimes, playing 4-on-4. There's been a talk about reducing the penalty time. Like an overtime penalty would be like a minute and a half.
Oh yeah.
Because, you know, if you think about it, you get a penalty in overtime, you're shorthanded for 40% of the overtime.
40% of OT, yeah. Yeah, well,
I guess I don't like that idea because, you know, then you messes up your stats. You know, it's like your penalties in minutes, you'd have 0.5 in there and stuff. And, you know, just keep it 2 minutes. And, hey, if it costs your team the game, well,
yeah,
don't do that.
Don't do it.
Yeah,
stupid. Move your legs, dummy. But, I, you know, that said, I got a feeling that this is coming to college. I don't
like it.
I don't like it either. I think it really cheapens the product.
I think it's entertaining, just like the Home Run Derby is entertaining, but I don't want to see it this
well
season.
So is the Family Guy, but I don't want to see Family Guy after 65 minutes of hockey. Well, I take that back, I do, but I mean, I don't want
would you be willing to show us your TiVo favorites list to prove that? Because
number one, number one,
like Family Guy.
Well, Jess, let me ask you this.
Sure.
At the XL Energy Center.
Take your time.
I will.
That's why he finds shootouts so exciting is because he watches the Wild play for 65 minutes.
I find the elevator ride exciting.
Throwing snowballs at beer cans would be exciting after that.
No pulling guard on this face-off play? What the hell is going on up here?
Student body right.
Stop. Do Wild fans get more excited for a Marian Gaborik penalty shot or in the shootout, or do they get more excited for a Derek Bogaert scrap?
Oh, no question.
Good question.
It's got to be Bogaert.
Absolutely, it's Bogaert.
No question
whatsoever. So why don't we just decide the game by having a scrap? We'll get the judges. We'll get both captains from each team, the head ref, and the two linesmen, and we'll line them up at a table, and then we'll put the guys in the center ice circle, have them drop the mitts and go, and then we give them 60 seconds to fight it out, and then the winner of the fight gets an extra point in the standings.
Wow.
Respect my authority!
Exactly.
That's not genius. That's rare genius right there.
Well, what happens if
saying.
What if happened
it's
to
the same thing?
What happened?
And the fans would love it.
But and if Bogaert caves a guy's face in, like he did last year,
yeah,
when he just about put his fist clean through Todd Fedoric's head,
Todd Fedoric is now his teammate, by the way.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry, I collapsed your head last year.
Hey, welcome aboard. Can I get you a straw?
Well, that's a whole different story.
Yeah.
And it's not college hockey related.
Vote no on the shootout.
Vote no on the college hockey shootout. Inches on the record as saying that.
I'm going to make a T-shirt. Maybe we should have a campaign at the Frozen Four.
Okay,
we'll have an information booth at the Frozen Four.
I know we've talked way too much about the WCHA, but let me just add one more little thing, and then we'll move on, I promise. We'll move east. National Geographic magazine.
Well, this is going to be relevant, isn't it?
National Geographic magazine did a piece this month about, it was entitled The Emptying Prairie. Okay, it was about a western state. I won't say which one. It was specifically about the western portions of this western state, which is very cold in the winter, very dry and arid in the summer. At one time, a lot of people tried to farm there. Now it has become, or is becoming, a ghost town kind of area, where all these former farms, former towns are just abandoned now. Fascinating photography, fascinating story. The governor of this state yesterday issued a statement up in arms about how this mischaracterizes their vibrant, growing state that they have, and and we're way off base. National Geographic has no idea what they're talking about and what a great place they live in, et cetera, et cetera. The headline I saw in a paper here yesterday was, "Hell hath no fury like a North Dakotan scorned." And I thought, man, if that doesn't apply to other areas of life.
Exactly. I believe.
Now I'm just putting sand in the wound.
There you go.
Now I am.
It blew across the prairie.
So, hey, I've been to eastern North Dakota. It's a very vibrant, hopping place. Fargo, Grand Forks, growing economy, all that. But
they got a Starbucks.
They have several Starbucks, and they're great people there. But
Chuck E. Cheese?
Interesting story, and I didn't take it to be a slap in the face to an entire state. But
I thought there was oil and coal out there.
There is, but it just doesn't take a lot of people to extract it. And the point of the story was 100 years ago, the railroads were crossing western North Dakota and convinced all these farmers, hey, we've got all this land, come on out here, farm, it's a paradise. And people got out there and built houses and built towns and all that, and it never
rained. Couldn't grow anything?
Yeah, it's just, it's not, it's too arid to be productive cropland on any kind of normally accepted scale.
So you can be a rancher or a...
You can be a rancher. It's not good cattle country either, because, again, it's too cold in the winter and it's too hot in the summer. Bison are huge out there, and bison are... growing things. Wind farms also.
Wind farms.
New emerging technology.
What are you growing? Wind?
Making power out of wind because, hey, the wind blows out there. So
high pressure systems.
So to our friends from North Dakota, please don't take this as a slap in the face. It's just, the pictures were beautiful. It's fascinating, but the governor's up in arms.
Okay, moving east to Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Oh, we are.
UM hasn't played anybody. True or false? Are they the number one team in the country? True or false? Well, they are.
Yes, they are. Because I looked at the polls the other day.
Should they be?
Sure enough, they're at the top. I think, I think that you can make an argument for Miami being number one. But I think Michigan has done enough to warrant that status right now. But getting to the first question, which is, have they played anybody? You look up and down their schedule, they played Boston College early in the year. They played Minnesota twice, played Wisconsin. not the same. Obviously, they played a Providence team that's okay. They played Bowling Green team. They played teams that are okay. But they haven't played the real elite teams yet. So I think as impressive as Michigan has been, I don't have any problem with people saying that the jury's still out on them, because we really haven't seen them play that elite team yet. And that stretch is coming up now, because they've got Notre Dame this weekend. They've got Michigan State right after that. Then it's two home games against Northern Michigan. Obviously, they should handle Northern Michigan. Then they're at Miami the first weekend in February. Actually, the second weekend in February, I should say, the 8th and 9th. So, I think that's. I certainly think that it's okay to be skeptical about them at this point in time.
Miami's the team to beat there?
I think so.
I think so, too. I saw them on TV, and I saw them. They have so many elements that make them so dangerous. They've got goaltending. They've got scoring. They've got depth, and they've got grit. And one thing that Seth Appert said, the Rensselaer head coach, after he played them, that was the nastiest team we played against as far as just being in your face and battling and competing and those elements that make it tough, especially when you get through the dog days of the season that we're currently in and when you get to the playoffs. I think Miami is just, they're built for an awfully long run this year, I think.
They're surprisingly deep. I shouldn't say surprisingly deep, but until you see them play and you kind of look at a line chart and you're like, holy man, I mean, they just keep throwing waves upon waves of people. at you, not just for, you know, rolling out forwards, but also on defense. I mean, they're as good a defensive core that you know, among their top six is that, as we've seen in some time, I think, in college hockey. I mean, there's really no drop off from one to six. They're that good. Nice mix of experience and youth, and then Zatkov. I mean, who's, you know, arguably, I think you got to consider him the best goalie in the nation right now.
Yeah.
There may be some argument. I guess you could put Bachman from Colorado College in there, you know, in that mix too. But if somebody gave me the choice between Bachman and Jeff Zatkov, I'm going to take Zatkov.
Kleine?
Well, I like Matt Kleine, but.
Yeah.
Pretty favorable schedule for the Redhawks coming up too.
Very favorable.
Couple at home with Lake Superior, the trip to Alaska, which is no fun, but then they have a week off before they have two at home with Michigan.
Yes.
And they finish up at Ferris, home with Western, and home and home with Ohio State. That's,
boy, you take nothing for granted, but that's a favorable schedule. There's no two ways about it.
Yeah, they got those two games against Michigan State and two games against Notre Dame out of the way in the first semester.
Mm-hmm.
And came out of those 3-1. So.
And then they played in the Ohio tournament.
Yeah.
And beat St. Cloud State there. You know, went to Rensselaer.
Non-conference win versus Ohio State. That one doesn't count in standings. But
correct.
So that'll be the five games versus the Buckeyes this year. Wow.
So really, I mean, realistically, if you look at, you know, if you match up the two team schedules, that, you know, obviously you've got to get the edge to Miami playing Michigan at home for two games here in February, and you know, that's really it for them. You know, they should, you almost expect them to, you wouldn't be surprised, let's put it that way, to see them win out. Whereas Michigan, you know, they play four against Michigan State, in addition to the two against Notre Dame and the two against Miami. So I mean, I think you have to get the edge to Miami, even though that they're still, you know, looking up at the Wolverines at this point in time.
How do you feel about Michigan's composition? We've talked early on about how young their lineup is, and now that they're 20-so games into the season, youth isn't as much of an issue. They should be immersed in the college hockey world enough to know what to expect, but, you know, are they going to be ready? Are they more prone to a meltdown or a sloppy performance than, say, a veteran team like Miami?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a fair statement. I mean, you know, Michigan's got some very good veterans, you know, starting with Porter, and then you know, you've got Kolarik and Matera on defense, who's actually been terrific this year. He's quietly had a All-American caliber season, just as far as being a shutdown defenseman and really just raising his level of play to a place that it hasn't been in his previous two seasons in Ann Arbor. But you know, I don't worry about their composition so much. I just wonder about these guys. You know, they had a lot of key guys go to go over to the Czech Republic for the World Junior Championship. I want to say off the top of my head, you know, four or five guys. I just wonder about, you know, those guys running out of gas as the season progresses. And as good as Billy Sauer's been, you know, you just wonder how long, or you keep waiting for the other shoe to drop regarding his play. You know, is he gonna turn into the Billy Sauer of old? Can he maintain this run that he's had from this point on through the end of the season? And you know, looking at their schedule, I'm going to say no, he probably can't. You know, somebody's going to light him up at some point in time. You know, and then what happens after that? Well, I think that's, you know, those two things concern me maybe more than the composition.
Let's talk about Hockey East. And
sorry.
What's funny? Not funny to you?
No, you like
UNH is funny?
It's like It's like the McLaughlin
Hockey East
group.
Is funny, like a clown. The McLaughlin group.
You're wrong. Next topic.
Jess, you can hang out at, or hang up at this point because we're talking about Hockey East.
I love Hockey East. I got my kid a BU hat for Christmas. Come on.
Wait, okay. Wait, our first semester.
Way to break the bank, by the way, on the gifts.
Oh wait, no, that was a stocking stuffer. That came from Santa Claus. That
oh, okay. All right. Wait a.
Kids, if you're listening, nothing.
Was there $500 in that hat?
The Doug Wu catcher.
No. Anyway.
Okay. Our first semester theme was Northeastern, UMass, until the later part of the, you know, December. UMass Lowell. These teams aren't going away. These are legitimate teams. And BU and Maine are certainly in down years, and they're not going to get out of it. But last week we started to see some turnaround with Northeastern splitting with Merrimack, Mass Lowell split with Providence in two overtime games. UMass played a home-and-home with New Hampshire, and the New Hampshire Wildcats won both of those. And at the same time, Boston College got 4 points against Vermont. Is there cause for concern for maybe that upstart group of Massachusetts, Northeastern, and UMass Lowell, that they should be wary of what's coming up in these next 6 or 7 weeks of the regular season?
That's a good question. That's a very good question. I think that, you know, I think that maybe the cause for concern isn't that the, you know, they don't have the talent to play with or stay in that upper echelon in Hockey East. It's how they'll handle the situation of, you know, being in a playoff race and competing for home ice in the first round and a potential NCAA berth. You know, of the three teams that we're specifically talking about, you know, UMass Lowell and Northeastern, I think UMass is probably best prepared to handle that. Because they went through it last year, and I think of the three, they're the most talented of that group. In fact, I saw their game on Friday. I watched a lot of it on TV. In fact, it was a great night to stay home and watch hockey. There were six games on the dish.
Just six games?
which was great.
Wow.
And I was really impressed with UMass through the first two periods. And, yeah. You know, and then I became very impressed with James Van Riemsdyk from there on out. But UMass is a talented team, very talented team. And I think that they're... You know, I can see them maybe emerging a little bit just because of their talent and their experience from last season. The other two, you know, you wonder if, you know, do they start looking and seeing the rankings and seeing their names up there high and the expectations start to build and the fans wonder, you know, can they hang on, especially in Northeastern's case, you know, being in Boston where they're a little under the microscope a little bit more, and we'll see what happens to them come bean pot time. You know, I'm very interested to see what happens with Northeastern down the stretch, just because I think, you know, you wonder how the expectations might catch up with that team, although they're a pretty talented club, too.
What they'll have to fight, to me... and Northeastern and UMass Lowell especially, is the "aw shucks, we're just happy to be here" mindset. Now, when they go into another team's rink, the other team says, "Aw gee, you know, this is a top 10 team. This is a top 15 team that's coming in here. These are good." And coaches will deny it, and they'll say it doesn't matter, and we treat every game the same, but it's a bunch of baloney. If you've got the number... you know, 6 or 7 team coming into your rink, your kid's going to be more fired up to play, you know, and you're going to get a tougher game. So now they've got to get over that because they're the team with the target on their back, that they're the team that other teams want to knock off, and they're the team that their opposition is trying to jump over in the standings instead of playing that underdog role or playing that upset-minded, you know, we can really make our weekend here if we, you know, get a couple points off of, you know, ranked opponent. So I think that'll be interesting for me to follow as we go down the stretch here.
Well, and the other thing, too, is let's not forget that there's no easy outs anymore in Hockey East. I mean, Merrimack vastly improved. Providence has shown that they're a very solid hockey team. Boston University and Maine, for all their struggles, are still Boston University and Maine. I mean, there's talent there. And those
It still has got to mean something when Maine comes to town, even if they're, you know, three wins in the conference right now. It's still Maine.
No, it does. Yeah, absolutely.
Minnesota's down right now. You tell me there's going to be any tickets available when they get to Duluth on Friday? I mean, it's still, you know, BU hasn't been to a Frozen in, what, 12 years? And you tell me it still doesn't mean something when BU's in the building? So.
Well, and I think that brings up a good point, too, about these teams is that, you know, regardless of how much success they're having here, teams like BU and Maine and these guys that have played in those programs for a while are used to going in and beating teams like Northeastern and UMass Lowell. So when they see those, you know, when they see those guys, they've got a certain degree of confidence that they can, you know, that they can handle them. And you know, regardless of what's going on with those teams and their respective records, I think that those feelings still exist within those programs. That there's an expectation at Maine that you beat Northeastern and you beat Lowell, and the same holds true at BU.
Here's my Hockey East question: Pierce Norton, junior forward at Providence, any relation to Bob Norton? Do we know? And where did he prep? Oh, Thayer Academy. So I found it.
Pierce Norton. He was great in those James Bond movies.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's no Sean Connery. But.
Well, who is?
Who is?
He's no George Lazenby.
Okay. We had, actually, in our outline, several other topics to discuss.
I think we've got to touch on one more, don't we?
I'm thinking we can hang on for a little bit of next week's podcast.
We'll definitely hang on to the Hobie talk.
Okay, that's the one I was going to hang on to for sure.
You know what? We'll hang on to the Canada talk too.
Yeah, we'll hang on to the Canada.
So this is a podcast teaser.
This is going to be a tease. Coming up at 11.
Podcast teaser. Coming up in the next InsideCollegeHockey.com podcast. Hobie Tracker.
Summer and Seth get into a fight. Oh, no, that's the OC. Never mind.
We'll talk about Canadian teams possibly joining the ranks of NCAA hockey.
They're coming to save the CHA.
Or are they?
When Alabama Huntsville and Simon Fraser get together, you can throw out the.
Actually, you know, I want to see Simon Fraser and Robert Morris.
Ooh.
you're gonna arm wrestle?
That actually sounds like two guys from the OC, doesn't it?
It sounds like two guys that ride those bicycles with a giant big wheel in the front and the handlebar mustache. Brilliant! Bully for you! Those big 1900s muscle men wearing like the singlet with one strap and lifting barbells.
Bare knuckle boxing. The winner gets John L. Sullivan.
The winner plays Notre Dame. Does that Notre Dame mascot have a name, or is it just...
He's just the leprechaun.
The leprechaun?
The leprechaun.
Proper noun.
Capitalized.
It's capital T, capital L.
Did he go to the Colorado College?
The Ohio State University.
The Ohio State University.
Okay, so in our next podcast, we'll have Canada discussion, we'll have Hobie discussion, we'll have College Hockey America discussion in our Canada discussion. We'll also talk about the Bemidji State Beavers, who have almost sealed up that regular season title in that league, facing a challenge that most other teams don't face, which is, okay, now what do I do for 6 weeks? We've got the number one seed.
I think Tom Cerutori should call Bill Belichick.
Yes, yes. And Joe Torre.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I don't know about that. Hey, I have one college hockey related note to pass along, and this caught my
That's
eye.
That's it.
Well, just in closing, I was looking through the transactions the other day and somehow stumbled upon the ECHL transaction and noted the Reading Royals out of Reading, PA, traded a guy to Bakersfield for a defenseman named Steven Later, who actually played for part of a season at Ferris State and then ended up going the major junior route. So I was just intrigued that Reading swung a trade for a player to be named Later.
I like it. Is Bakersfield the Condors?
Yes.
Yes.
Would that mean that their mascot would be Condor Man?
I don't know what that means.
Bad Disney movie from about 1979, but anyway.
When was 1979?
Exactly. Said the 80.
It's child of the 80s.
It's more than just a song by Smashing Pumpkins.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Okay, I have one closing college hockey.
Player to be named Later. Come on.
No, we liked it. It was good.
I liked it.
We'll put in the laugh track later.
Mm. Yeah, post-production laugh track.
Note to self.
At 1:17, 52. All right.
You guys know me. I always study history. I always look for patterns.
That's right.
Denver's going to win the Frozen Four this year. Yeah. Because they win the Frozen Four every time, every year that the Frozen Four and the Democratic National Convention are in the same building in the same year. Think about it.
Hmm.
Boston?
Boston, 2004. Denver, 2008.
Wow.
Just saying. Thought about that as I was walking into the Xcel Energy Center, which is the site of the Republican National Convention in this country.
It is?
It is.
Are you excited about
that? Republicans are coming to St. Paul, and I'm leaving town.
Yeah. Enjoy that, Jess.
Yeah.
Huckabee
Come on,
fever.
Take it down to the airport. We can see the Fred Thompson motorcade.
I don't think you have to worry about that.
Nah.
Okay.
Isn't there a guy named Dylan Hunter?
No, not that I'm aware of. I think you're thinking about the OC again.
No, I swear to God, look it up. He's a California guy. I thought I saw a guy named Dylan Hunter running.
And he's running for president?
I think so. I think he's a Republican.
No.
I don't pay attention to that. I don't pay attention to that side. Let's put it bluntly.
Yeah.
I think I'm obviously not as political as Jess, but I'm probably more political than Gladdy. I think I'm going to vote for Hillary Clinton just because I want Bill Clinton in the White House for 4 more years. Talk about shenanigans. While Hillary's away running the country, it's going to be like Weekend at Bernie's at that place. It's going to be like old school. Frank the Tank.
I knew this is exactly where I left it 5 years ago.
There's that bag of weed.
Alcohol is bad.
Wow.
I did not have sex with.
All right.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's why I am here to publicly state that my vote will be decided for purely comedy purposes.
You are a U.S. American.
I'm a lifelong Minnesotan. Let me just say, we tried that once. We elected a pro wrestler governor. It was.
Yeah, but
novelty governors get old after about.
Yeah, but you know, when Gorilla Monsoon was the lieutenant governor, that was pretty cool.
I think, uh-oh. I looked all over the internet.
remember that?
Guys.
Are we going into wrestling territory?
We've already done this podcast. We've already done this deterioration.
we'll back away from the abyss.
I think I hear Fuji-san in the background.
So wait a minute. Which is a red state, or is that a maroon state?
Next week on the Best Of podcast.
Yes, Bus, you mentioned that in passing. That
I do
have compiled a best of inch podcast.
I've narrowed it down to the five best moments. And at some point in time, I'm going to get motivated enough to put them together in some sort of hilarious format. And we'll roll them out. I think I had omitted the color debate.
Can Casey Kasem come in and count us down?
Number
now on the countdown.
It'll be 20 seconds long and it'll be all bumper music.
Very and Hockey East racial slurs.
Yeah.
I heard Jeff Howe was hired by Golf Channel. Is that true?
Oh man.
Wow. I think maybe that didn't happen.
Aren't we doing a napkin on top things you can't say on the podcast?
I think isn't today honestly maybe not today, but coming up I think is Willie O'Ree's the 50th anniversary of when he played his first game in the NHL.
Yes, I believe so.
It's coming up soon. In fact, it might be even be this weekend.
I saw an interview with Willie O'Ree at the game I was watching on the West Coast. I believe it was the Sharks and Canucks.
January 18th,
1958. 50 years.
Friday it will be 50 years.
Fitting this week that also today, Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday. His actual birthday is today.
It's fitting. I'm not Willie O'Ree. He's a darn nice guy. Very soft-spoken. Loves to talk hockey. Great guy.
Still out there working.
Yeah.
Good for
him. He was on the newfangled television.
lives in San Diego, but he's everywhere. They need, NHL calls and says we need to do a clinic wherever, and he's on a plane and he's there. At I think he's 72 years old now, so...
I think he's older than that.
And one other thing that came through in the interview that I saw with him is that he's been very active in, doing clinics and public appearances, those kinds of things, but more tangible work that he's been a big part of getting rinks built in California.
Yes.
You can't play hockey in California without indoor facilities.
No, and obviously college hockey should be very grateful for his efforts, because the game has been impacted
positively by California players.
Yes, and will continue to grow.
Yes.
So on that note, salute.
Kevin Allen from USA Today just did a nice piece about Willie O'Ree, and one of the things that really struck me is, there's inevitably pioneers like him and like Jackie Robinson before him. There's inevitably stories about knuckleheads making death threats or sending threatening letters. And And we talked about this as, you know, something he's had to deal with just like any other pioneering athlete like that. What really struck me, he's gotten letters as recently as, you know, a couple of years ago from, you know, small-minded knuckleheads saying, you know, we don't want your kind here talking to our kids. Stay home. Well, it's like, my God, what part of 1943 are we living in? Anyway, there's my rant.
Thank you, Captain Bringdown.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, whatever.
Now here's something we hope you'll really like.
So this guy walks into a bar.
Ouch.
Ouch.
All right. Let's
wrap
this up.
This guy walks into a library.
My dogs are giving me the stink eye.
That doesn't sound very comfortable. Okay. Thank you for listening to the InsideCouchHockey.com podcast.